you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
Hi, I'm Jordan Harbour. Thank you for listening to the Twilight Histories. Today, you'll hear an incredible story written and produced by Tristan Verboven. It's called The Northwest. If you enjoy this story and you'd like to hear more, please join us on Patreon. Head on over to the website at twilighthistories.com and click through to our Patreon page to sign up. And now for today's show, The Northwest, by our modern bard, Tristan Verboven.
We assure you that the last 6 months of cardio training and wilderness survival will finally pay off. There's an opening, and we've found just the thing. You requested something outdoorsy, athletic, but no more of these war scenarios. It's understandable. You are about to go on a great adventure. Unspoiled wilderness, and the best of companions. First, let's make sure you look the part. Trousers and a loose-fitting shirt, floppy toque, kerchief, and most important, a broad fleshette sash tied around your waist. It's too early in the season for winter gear, but anyway, let's just get you on your way. It's spring of 1803. The ice is breaking up on the St. Lawrence River. The first ships are arriving in the port, and you have a long way to go before the rivers freeze up again. Welcome to Montreal. Get that smell, that fragrance of bales of tea and tobacco, musty wool blankets in stacks, and leather and gunpowder. There's a clerk in suspenders going down a list, pointing to each bundle. It'll be down to Lachine by mule this afternoon. Unless you've something to add. He hands over the bill to sign. Throw in a couple of good bottles of rum, says a voice from the doorway. You'll be needing those.
Certainly, Mr. McTavish.
Mr. McTavish signs the bill and leads the way out into the noise. There are transport ships along muddy embankment, crude gangplanks, and goods being unloaded in heaps on the cobblestone, newcomers on sea legs. Mr. McTavish plops his tri-quarter hat and adjusts his fine frock coat. And through the log constructions and narrow streets, you enter a limestone facade. The sign says, Northwest Company. Up some creaky stairs to an office overlooking the busy square. He collapses into a plush easy chair, offering a seat facing.
I needn't remind you of the gravity of the situation we're in, he says grimly. It may look like we're in good business on the face of it, but the wolves are at the gates.
He unrolls a map and holds it in place with paperweights.
So this is us, Montreal.
His finger rests on the bottom right corner of the map.
By morning, your party will leave from Lachine Factory, up the Ottawa River, through the Great Lakes, and you'll report to us at Grand Portage.
He looks up at you, smiling.
That should take us to late June.
He notices your confused look.
Don't worry, I'll be heading up the rear in the last boat out. That's how you know it's over. But you'll be in good company. The men are excellent fellows. They've been with us a few seasons now, and I'd have you travel in my company, but I prefer to embed you with some of the men. Keep your ears open. They won't speak as freely if they think you're a bourgeois from the company. So, you know, best to gain their confidence. Paddle and Portage is one of them. Carry your own bales. That's how you get respect. McTavish looks you up and down. Besides, I want you looking and smelling like one when we get to Grand Portage. You like boats? He waits for a nod. Huh? Do you like singing? You will. It's only upstream for the first 3 weeks, and then down the French River to the Great Lakes, and you'll reach Grand Portage, and we'll find some good men to take you up north to Athabasca. He points to the mostly uncharted section of the map. It's connected by a few hastily drawn rivers, and it's up in the northwest. Peace River, he announces. Alexander Mackenzie. He told us it was a veritable El Dorado of beaver and foxes, the richest he'd seen. And he should know. The natives are reasonable. I just wish it wasn't so far away. He gets up to close the door. 3 days up the Peace River, we built a trading post at Fort St. John. He hushes his voice. The last party to reach it tells us it was burned to the ground. Clerks nowhere to be found. Not a man dares to return. Rumors of strange natives, Métis, armed. Looks I wish we'd never seen. He rolls up the map and leans forward to meet your gaze. This a murder case. Utmost secrecy. We must not let this out. I suspect foul play from our rivals. 40 miles from Hudson Bay territory, but we can't know for sure, and I can't have the men spreading rumors. That could be worse than a cabal of old hags. That's why we need you, deep north. You'll winter there. You'll be with some capable men. And return by spring to report to me directly. Handing over a sealed letter, he stands to show you out of the room. You don't speak much. That's good. Don't let those pork eaters lead you astray. Mouth shut, eyes open. Present this letter to any man at the company, and you shall not want. Make your way to Lachine at once. You'll be leaving at first light, and I'll see you at Grand Portage. Fort William, it's called now. He gives a sly grin. You will not want to miss the feast. The mule is ready with a cargo the weight of a man. And this cargo will become very familiar. A few hours of mule train and then you're face to face with another clerk. A stone and timber warehouse at the bank. And a town dwarfed by a church and nunnery. And there's a musky breeze of fur and leather. After a quick glance at McTavish's letter, and with a grunt, the clerk points to the riverbank. With scores of beached canoes, each long enough for 6 men to lay flat in the hull and 2 abreast. Welcome to your new home, he motions to the craft. And your new family? The men are packing their bundles beneath the gunwales, with just enough room for their legs, and they gather around gawking in the same breeches, shirts, and red sashes.
Aye, le petit nouveau! Il nous joint jusqu'à Grand Portage. C'est tout un petit bourgeois, n'est-ce pas?
He approaches with a grin.
On l'appelle petit comment, celui-là? You look like a petit bourgeois. We call you Thibault.
The men approve.
Moi, c'est Mano. Lui, c'est Pitou.
Nice to meet you.
The rest, c'est des voyous. You will know them all soon.
The men get back to work loading the boat. The long craft without keel or rudder, made entirely of whole strips of birch bark, and a wooden frame held together by pitch and leather straps. Yet tons of gear are being loaded, and bow to stern, and marked in a native emblem with the letters NWC. The boat fully stocked, the men start drinking. By nightfall, the waterfront is swarming with voyageurs, taking in the last earthly pleasures around a roaring bonfire,
They cook one last meal and drink to their thirst. Each of them ending up on their knees before a relic of St. Anne, finding a sleepy corner of a cellar chapel. By morning they are forgiven, and at first light, heavy hulls crack the calm waters of the St. Lawrence, casting long shadows into the ripples. Chimney smoke at Lachine becomes a scatter of farms leading to a wide lake. The vessel strains the first paddle strokes, but then slowly breaks the current. Your view is from starboard bow. 12 men, 2 abreast. A rudder oar named Fournier, and Gros Malin at the stern. The paddles start to sink until they no longer make a splash, only a chorus of tiny whirlpools spinning off into the dark waters. The men break into song. Your months of physical training have paid off. And though it's difficult at times to keep up, the paddles in strict unison, kept up by a stiff shoving from behind. And after 2 hours of hard thrust, Gros Malin mercifully calls for a break.
Allez les gars, prenez vos pipes.
Out come the tobacco pipes, and the craft drifts into an eddy. It's difficult for you not to slump over your gunwales, gasping, exhausted, and yet the other men calmly take to their smoke. In a few short minutes of tobacco and quipping spent, the paddles are drawn up again, and the cycle continues. Bursts of intense labor, short smoke breaks, and nothing to do but fall into the rhythm. Paddles breaking the surface, down into the currents, creeping through a curtain of lush that never changes, never the same twice. By the first day, you reach the mouth of 2 rivers, and specks of human life on the shores, nuns and children waving. The man on the boat know it well. It is the last glimpse of Christianity. And from here on in, the savage world. Each burst of intense paddling, finished with a well-deserved pipe break, the older men know them as ritual. Balancing the fickle craft, they stretch their shoulders and bathe their faces in cold river. And at day end, before collapsing aching bones onto a bedroll, each man holds his charge up a natural path. And once again, months of training on the Stairmaster finally pay off. This path of 50 feet is made grueling under the weight. The most impressive spectacle by Fournier and Gros Malin, who expertly shoulder the enormous craft up the crag and bush. When
when the bundles are dumped at the clearing.
And the first portage, it feels like the hardest.
Mano chuckles.
But when you get to Grand Portage, you'll remember this one. It was the easy one.
First come the mosquitoes. But the real villainy is the black fly. Invisible, unstoppable even through clothing, and everywhere. Until the rain scares them off, leaving the men shivering under the hull of the canoe, desperate to sleep. Many days of this, or has it been weeks? How many back-breaking portages? Entire days forgotten, eyes closed, and the rhythm permeates the darkness. The backs of men, the pulsating wake of the keel. There are no more hours and minutes, only portages and songs and pipes and paddle strokes to keep time. And by night, in the glow of the fire, it's pemmican, sausage and gruel, and curling up to the embers. Some of the men are French, raised in New France, and settlers of the St. Lawrence Valley, sons of the fur trade. A few Métis, some Scotsmen, a Dutchman. And during their pipes they tell tall tales. There's an outcropping called Cake Bend, where a coureur de bois named Gâteau once disappeared into the night. 10 pipes later, a cluster of trees like a swinging cleaver. They call it Le Boucher. And at Rideau Falls, stretched out like a curtain, the crew half drags the craft demi-charge through the shawls. And there's a settlement, the men say, was not there the year before, and already great timbers have been felled for the journey down the river come fall. The next landmark causes a stir, a steep bend. And the bleached bark of a birch stands alone among maples at a hilltop cross. The Calvary, they call it.
Le Calvaire, c'est ce qui s'en vient, mon ami.
The water becomes rough and rocky. Portages become harder, steeper and longer. And a treacherous current. Then, muddy moose tracks up cliffs laden with bundles. No more pipes for a while. The hard men curse the green ones, and the pace becomes impossible. As they collapse under the heavy rain, weeping under their charge, were it not for the mirth of their comrades' unbreakable good-natured song to lift their spirits. Days of this come to patches of deep water, and a few sacred moments to rest paddle on knee. And in the distance, the smoky haze of a native town, a line of beached canoes, and the confluence of half a dozen streams widen the banks to a mile across. The Fournier, standing proud, points to a sandy jetty, and the men pick up the pace. The craft nears shallow water, and
Gros Malin, with a sly grin, jumps out. There's an eeriness all around. The men avoid your glance as they hop out to guide the thwart to shore. You're waist deep in clear water, and the men standing around you in a semicircle. Fournier and Gros Malin, their arms crossed. A deep smile in their eyes. The feeling of strong arms grab your shoulders and turn the sky to riverbed. The world spins out of control. For a few moments, terror sets in. All there is to do is flail in panic. And during the horrible moments between plunges, nothing but laughing faces of the crew. And on the fifth pass, Fournier calls to cease. He approaches calmly, laying a cross gently with his fingertips above your brow, reciting the Trinity.
Et voilà, mon cher Thibault. You are baptized. Did you bring something to fill the chalice?
McTavish's bottle of rum. This must be the moment to pull it out. The men degenerate into a frenzy as you produce it, passing it around, swigging. There's no more work this day, not even a camp assembled. The men take to a night of singing and game traded from the natives, who sit at a distance from the crackling pops of flame watching. The rising sparks meet the milky stars. A curtain of northern lights connects worlds. A mirror of savage, pristine logic. An interconnected maze. And we, explorers, pushing our crafts into darkness, a voyageur in the great fur trade. But something is afoot. And there's a mystery at the end of this highway of lakes and rivers. In the deep north, if God were watching, he would scarcely have a say. There are only the ambitions of men and the appetites of beasts. The bottle is passed and then emptied and then thrown unceremoniously into the flow. It's deep water for days until water shed, and then a portage down to the French River. And paddling with the flow is a new sensation. Heavy rains make easy work of the muddy shawls, and the westernmost outlet opens suddenly to a vast lake. More like an ocean to see its distant shores with its swells and wave break. Fournier and Gros Malin know the route through a maze of coastal islands. And one day, the craft coasts silently through a still patch. Only ripples from the bow and the plop of aquatic life. Fournier raises his paddle dripping into the stillness. And with a single swipe, strikes a stone like a gong.
C'est la cloche,
Pitou whispers. Raising his paddle in turn, he rings it out again, crossing his chest in prayer. The next days are boggy swamp and terrifying bays paddled furiously, sometimes thrown miles off course by a breeze, and the keelless craft on open water, until Sault Ste. Marie. A huddle of farms and a stockade, and first familiar trappings in weeks. The men pull the canoe through a narrow canal as Fournier reports in to the clerk. Some cargo is traded for pemmican and sausage, and now the final stage. They say the most dangerous one yet. Lake Superior, as the name implies, is very big. Even bigger than the lake you were just on. And without the cover of marshy inlets, there's nothing to protect the canoe for the next 10 days. It is a furious mad dash through open water. The currents pull the craft away from the shore and unnerving swells, then fog. And the men erect a crude sail to harness the wind, only to be struck on a rocky shore for days awaiting thunder and lightning skies. One such night, the craft is thrown ashore, and some men brave the bush for pine pitch and bark to mend the hull. Another restless day, and the destination is in frustrating reach, and Fournier gathers the men around a fire to raise their spirits.
Old Lady Wind, she won't be angry for long. We'll be riding her again. So get your rest while you can, Liga. 4 days. 4 more days and you'll see your wives. And the great feasts.
The men all grumble, and Gros Malin interjects.
This year we go to Fort William. It's the new factory. Grand Portage is part of the new United States now. The new place is closer. Got the better portage. I hear those United States got their eye on our business up here,
says one of the men.
A lot of those loyalists, they're spies, and making deals with the Iroquois, trying to push out our business. Don't worry about those southerners,
laughs another.
They couldn't survive a day up here in the winter.
Fournier laughs too.
I'd like to see them paddle up to Athabasca like some kind of army. Nobody in charge up there. You've been up there, Gros Malin,
says one of the younger men.
Is it as tough as they say?
He responds, smiling.
It take a special kind of guy to live up north. Most of them, when they become homme du nord, they either stay forever or they don't never come back.
J'ai parti pour vendre ma femme, une petite grosserie, mais c'est pas cher pour une bonne femme, si bien que moi de partout. J'ai demandé au commis si vous la achetez une femme. Et j'ai demandé pour le prix, il m'a dit pour 3-30 tout, mais c'est pas cher pour une bonne femme, si bien que moi de partout. Si elle fait pas votre affaire, vous la ramènerez chez nous. Si la porte est pas ouverte, vous la pendrez au pio, mais c'est pas cher pour une bonne femme, si bien que moi de partout. Si la porte est pas ouverte, vous la pendrez au pio.
The spirit comes back to the men as they break into another song, and then early to their bundles should the waters be still by morning. And at first light, the canoe is cutting the clear water due west of Fort William. On the north coast, a savage place. Few beaches, little cover, and lurking with bears and wolf packs. But there's no time to ponder with Fort William on the horizon. The gateway to the north. Fournier guides the craft ashore just before their arrival, to slick back their shaggy locks and bathe naked in the shallow, rubbing their flesh with fragrant leaves. Adorned with flowers and a crown, they prepare for sport. Shouting taunts and promises, the men plunge their paddles to pound the surface like hammers. The prows poke back and forth into the lead. And the ford ahead,
is enough to push the men into a frenzy until the shallow draft skids on the soft beach. They storm ashore to embrace the comely women waving scarves in the wind. Pitou plucks his from her feet and placing his crown on her brow. Fournier calls the men back to unload and secure the boat. And within minutes, the cargo sits dry in a factory. The men are set loose while clerks in Waistcoast take stock. And the hours bring the arrival of more boats, more rowdy men, until the beaches are teeming. On the fifth day, the last team arrives. First, boats bearing sacks of food and live pig and grouse. And then, a team of bakers and cooks, followed by fiddles and horns, and bagpipes announce Mr. McTavish himself. With his own flechette around his military coat, placing his foot upon terra firma.
Gather around, men of the Northwest Company! Our great journey west once again conquered! Stewards! Open those barrels! Can't you see that these men are thirsty?
Whiskey and rum, having spent these weeks in passage from Lachine, and before that from the belly of a Caribbean hulk, and devoured without restraint. And the men, maddened beasts, taken to song and drink, waddle to the comfort of their wives, fighting and singing and fighting again around dozens of bonfires. And at nightfall, McTavish orders the great doors open, and an orchestra beams out onto the lake, and the couples dance until their backs are drenched with sweat, and laid out across long tables, a feast of fowl and pork, stuffing their faces and throwing their women over their shoulders into the night. The men have a wife in every one of these forts, he chuckles. And the women, they have many husbands in one fort. But tonight, they are kings, the mightiest of warriors. McTavish leads the way through a small door. His desk has all the accoutrements of an office, ink blots and paper and filers, and from a fine bottle he pours two glasses. Within a fortnight, they will turn their canoes, laden with a fortune of beaver pelts, and then back to Montreal. He unrolls the map, and your journey will continue north. I've heard, sir, that the new United States have an eye on this enterprise. I've heard the same, he replies. And after a long pause, he continues. They've been out of the pelt game for some time, and the only decent furs left are up in Athabasca. And the only men worthy of bringing them here, well, you will meet them. McTavish throws back his tiny glass and pours another. Man by the name of Pond, one of those loyalists from the south, he was one of the first Christians to reach Athabasca, looking for a passage north. Most of the men in Montreal don't trust him, nor do I, but he's a good man in the bush. He fills his glass again. If anyone's after our forts, McTavish continues, it's the Hudson Bay Company. We've had our quarrels in the past with the HBC, but raiding tiny outposts, it's just not their style. He smooths out the surface of the map. These men'll meet you on the other side of Dog Lake. He gives a chuckle. Just a portage for you, but a bridge to another world. And from there, Lake Winnipeg, then Fort Chipewyan, and then on to the Peace River. He rolls up the map. Pond. He knows the way. And he knows you're working for me. And he's the only one who can take you that far. So keep your wits about you. You'll find out who's behind this. He stubs out his cigar. But now you're cut out for this, he grins. Just look at the sight of you. We'll make an umdunor out of you in no time. Dog Lake supplies a different breed of men. The winters up north show on their faces, and despite the heat, they arrive in lush fur and wool blankets tailor fit with fine beadwork and stitch from the hands of native wives. And there sits Pond, wide-brimmed hat, leaning on a long musket, with his fox cloak. His companion, a handsome young Métis man in decorative leather vest and floppy hat. They wave you over. You the rider. His voice is gruff and impatient.
All right, those are your bales. That's your paddle.
He points to the canoe beached by the river.
And that's your new home.
The canoe is the same as the Montreal craft, but smaller with a lighter bark and easily handled by a team of three in their gear. At first, the portages are shorter than the Great Lake run, but it's easy to get lost in the labyrinth of lakes, swamps, and streams. Rather than pipes, your companions make stops at trap lines and supply caches. The wilderness training comes in handy, and they are impressed when you bag a few hares of your own. But the days are grueling upstream slogs, and then relief of deep water. But your daily ordeal has become so commonplace. 14-hour days in ignoring the pouring rain. In a week past Dog Lake, the bundles are unloaded and carried up a path well-worn by moose and man alike. And at the peak, Pond lowers the canoe to the ground before a tangled, stunning land of savage beauty. And then, with a beaming smile, he calls back. Where's that good bottle of Madeira that McTavish packed for you? The bottle is fished out from the roll of blankets and tobacco. Biting the cork out with his teeth, Pond takes a swig and passes around. Welcome to the north, he beams. Anyone who passes the height of the land here is an umdunor in my book. With every swallow, Pond tells more of his adventures, breaching the northern watershed and following the flow to the Pacific. I never knew for sure where I was, but many times I thought I could smell the salt air. John Owl grew up in Fort Capel, raised by an aunt from the Blackfoot. He knew for sure, but not exactly how, that his father was a Frenchman. He could read a little, taught by Jesuits during the long winter at Fort Pitt. Barely a Christian, though he knew the Lord's Prayer. And 2 weeks in, and Rainy Lake spills out into the last stretch of deep water into rough. 80 miles long and wide through a maze of islands and inlets, and without a good guide would lead to madness. Magnificent granite cliffs in clear waters. The river broadens again at Lake Winnipeg, and the other parties across the inland sea, and with the same squalls and swells, to Cumberland House, the only four walls and a roof for another 1,000 miles. The other crews take the Saskatchewan River to Fort Pitt, and more formidable men travel the winding lakes to Watershed North, and then to Chipewyan. And at Lac La Rouge, Pond pulls ashore to the north bank and climbs to a good view over the Churchill River meandering east, where he sees some native canoes in the distance. "They'll trade their pelts at Churchill Factory," he says, closing his spyglass. "Hudson's Bay, the company. They own everything you see and more. And everything behind us is the Northwest Company, and it goes to Montreal." After a long pause, he speaks solemnly. "Everything in between is fair game." At Lac La Loche, a bottleneck converges, and the sight of so many men is jarring, and the ground is churned under laden boots of 12 miles of portage, the longest one yet, the only way north to Athabasca and east to Hudson Bay. And so the boggy path is now an ambuscade of black flies and mosquitoes preying on men unable to swap them. A patch of toil 1,000 miles from comfort. It seems that the worst has passed. Now just gripping monotony. The same day passes again and again. Only a few rapids at demi-charge, and flat country, windy skies, starlit nights, to the great Athabasca Lake. And the far side at last, Fort Chipewyan. Nothing more than a chimneyed square and a crude palisade. In it, scarcely a European, but the bourgeois who keeps a tiny office between stacks of pungent furs and hanging castoreum. The letter from McTavish receives a suspicious look from the Scotsman, but Pond puts everyone at ease. "We'll rest here a few days," he announces, helping himself to the stool in the corner. "Then we'll proceed unburdened to the Peace River. The men in Montreal want to know why their trading posts have been raided." He lights a pipe, leaning into the corner. "And I'd like to know, too." The Peace River is neither wide nor deep, but the heavy rains make it navigable. Paddling upstream again takes some getting used to, but without cargo or ballast, the craft sits high on the water. First to Fort Vermilion, manned by 2 clerks and 6 men of the north, with no reports from the Peace River in months, and nothing since the raid on Fort St. John. "What about the Dunza?" says Pond, unimpressed with this story. "The beaver tribe. They must have seen something." The men just nod. The farther up the river, the more anxious Pond gets, and even John Owl starts the slightest sound. It is now September. The journey began in May at first thaw. The nights are cold enough now that the black flies have thinned out, and the Peace River meanders south into country known by few. And Pond pulls the craft ashore, takes out his map. "I reckon we're nearing the old outpost," looking warily down the river. We should take it by foot. The water here is easy to regain should we run into sport. Musket over his shoulder, he leads the way into the brush. And after a few minutes, Pon ducks down in a motion to be silent. He and John Owl crawl nimbly to a vantage point between the two pines. Flat on his belly, he takes out his spyglass. Nestled in the valley, a huddle of buildings under a din of brown smoke. And Pond passes the spyglass. At the gate, half a dozen native women stretch pelts on a rack. Some near some makeshift tents and fires piled with wood. And a sturdy palisade and a log construction. And a worn path to the river. And some native men bringing fish. And Pond and John Owl look perplexed.
HBC, you reckon?
Wonders Pond.
There's no way,
answers John Owl.
We're too far past the watershed. They'd never come down here.
There's only one way to find out, says Pond sternly.
We'll have to ask them ourselves.
With the spyglass carefully in his pocket and the musket loaded, he makes his way down the slope, and John Owl follows carefully. Nobody stirs as you approach the enclosure. The native women hardly look up from their work. They have strange faces. They're not Dunza. They're not Cree. They're not Plains. They're not from here at all. And as soon as the inside of the fort can be seen, the camp comes to life. Men start shouting and standing around you in a circle. And then more men, soldiers, European men with tall woolen hats and long coats with brass buttons. And then an older man, balding and stout, a gentleman, emerges from the main building, throwing on a fur collar. A flag flies above the doorway, but it's difficult to make out. White, blue, red. John Owl looks to Pond, who is gently placing his musket on the ground and showing his hands. These are definitely not HBC men. These men are Russians.
Mais j'ai travaillé toute la semaine, puis j'ai pas tiré une douzaine. Et envoyé en avant nos gens, et envoyé en avant. Et quand j'ai parti pour voyage, j'ai regardé ces petits conscrits. Oh, j'ai resté ma bonne famille en arrière, ces vieux souvenirs. Et à chaque fois qu'à ma voix venir, et envoyé en agent nos gens, et envoyé en avant. Mais j'ai travaillé toute la semaine, puis j'ai pas tiré une douzaine. Et quand ils voyaient ces jeunes gars et qu'ils passaient dans le Canada, et en voyant ces petits soldats et ils partaient pour les voyages, ils ont parti pour si longtemps, on regardait ce que je voyais, et en voyant en avant nos gens, et en voyant en avant.
That was The Northwest by Tristan Verboven. Please join our Patreon community and help us create more shows like this one. We rely on our patrons, and this show is entirely sponsored by our community. With more patrons, we can grow this podcast by creating more stories for you. Trust me, we are not short on quality creators hungry to produce fantastic shows. In fact, I've had to tell them to please hold back and wait, which is painful to do when I know they're hungry to create for you. What we need are patrons, like you, to support these creators. The more patrons we have, the more quality shows we can release to you. It's as simple as that. When you join our Patreon community at the agent level or higher, you gain access to a ton of members-only shows. You also get early access to shows sometimes months in advance, and some experiments that never even made it to the podcast. Please visit the website at twilighthistories.com and follow the link to our Patreon page. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thanks for listening to the Twilight Histories. Until next time, take care.